Okay, everybody. Welcome to this last session of this afternoon and of the whole conference. As you might know, they call this the graveyard slot, and it's my opportunity to fill this in and hopefully bring some value to you guys in this last session of the day. So the session of today is best practices for using open source software in the enterprise. And before I get started, I just want to shortly introduce myself. My name is Marcel de Vries. I come from the Netherlands. I work for a company called Xpirit. And Xpirit is a company that just started last week. Last week, we just started this new company. So a real startup. Really delighted with that. And we do like high-end consulting for Microsoft Application ALM. We're doing Windows Azure, and we're doing a lot of stuff also in the mobility space, so building enterprise mobile applications. I'm also a Microsoft MVP and a regional director. And besides that, when I have time left in the evenings, I spend time building courses for Pluralsight. So I build a course on IntelliTrace, which really dives deep into even kernel-level debugging. Test automation with Coded UI. Test automation is one of the things that I spend a lot of time with. And I work a lot for large enterprise customers, helping them improve their ALM processes to do, for example, continuous delivery and continuous deployments. If you want to, you can have a look at my blog at fluentbytes.com, and please reach out to me at Twitter with @MarcelV if you want to connect with me. If you have any questions left after this session, please come up to me if you need additional information or help in this space. For people that will sit out the whole afternoon, I have some goodies to give away regarding Pluralsight. So if you're not a Pluralsight subscriber yet, come to me and I have at least a month of free subscription for you, which is way more than you can get online at the moment. With that out of the way, let's get started on best practices in open source. So if you look at how software is built today, you can see that more about 80% or more of the software that you build is your code plus some glue code and then a lot of components that you get for free from the internet. And for free means that we can just download this stuff and then those components can be used and we can just utilize stuff. And really what it comes down to is just building on the shoulders of giants. You have like the Googles, the Microsofts of these worlds. They publish a ton of software that we can just leverage. And what you see today is that I even talk to still people that want to write their own FTP libraries or want to write their own complete web stacks. But that said, I think it's more smart to do is, and be more productive. It's just using and leveraging what's all available to us in the open source world. Now, the thing with open source is that I think that a lot of people are not even aware of the amount of open source they are already using. So who of you are in this room web developers today? A lot of you. So just let have a short look at what you might be using already, what you don't even know yet. So I'm here in Visual Studio, and when I just go to File New Project, if I can click right, File New Project, and we select something like a web application, and let's go for an ASP.NET web application, MVC, okay? Now you see that the template unfolds, and it's doing a lot of adding stuff, and what it adds is it's adding a bunch of what we call NuGet packages. And those NuGet packages come off a NuGet feed. And as you might know, a lot of that stuff is open source today. So if we look over here and go and have a look at what we all pulled in our project here, you can see this whole list of stuff. And this is all being open source. This is just all the stuff that you're retrieving from the web. So all of a sudden, I just do File New and already have a bunch of open source stuff in there. Now imagine that you need to write this stuff all yourself. Who of these web developers that just rose their hand work for an enterprise? A lot of you. So then the question is, how can we cope with open source if we are already using it or if we want to start leveraging it. Because when I talk to the enterprise, like CXO level people, they always say, well, open source, we're not sure about that, it's being dangerous, and all of a sudden I need to publish all my intellectual property as well. And what I will do today is I will show you some of the stuff that we can do in terms of mitigating those risks, in terms of what is your liability if you're using open source. I want to have some talking points on how you can also contribute to open source. And what I will show you today is a product that you can use to keep track of what's being used in your enterprise, and based on that, learn from known vulnerabilities that you get from outside as well. Because, well, you can get components in, but how secure are those components? That's always the question, of course, as well. So that was just a very short introduction in terms of what is it all that you have in open source. And before you even know it, you might already getting a lot of open source inside your organization without even noticing, because people just do file new and have a new project there. So if you look at ASP.NET, you saw that ASP.NET itself these days is already open source. We have stuff like Entity Framework with Microsoft now open source. We have jQuery, Angular, Bootstrap, you name it. It's all open source out there that we need to learn and work with. So if you see the pickup in terms of open source, you see that it's really a tremendous growth in the adoption of open source anywhere in any organization, being it an enterprise or a startup. And this is based on a survey done by Sonatype, which is only focusing on the Java side of things, okay? Not even looking at what we're doing in the .NET world and in the web space. So you can see there's a tremendous growth of packages that you pull from the outside into your organization starting doing your work on. Now, some of you might already have discovered this, is that there's a whole new Microsoft out there these days. You see that all of a sudden Microsoft is now doing this whole cross-platform thing, and they're targeting iOS and Android, and they're doing, of course, stuff on their Windows platform. Microsoft now embraces open source, and they even open sourcing their own software as well. How many of you are currently using Linux environments in their organizations? A couple of you, okay. And who of you are all using Windows then? Okay, a lot of you are lying because you're not raising any hands here. You should use Windows or either Linux, right? It would be something. You might run on your own OS, perhaps, but that's not very common to do, but okay. So what you see is that, for example, in Windows Azure, you see a lot of these Linux distributions that you can just spin up and kick its tires or just use in production. And Microsoft is publishing a lot of their new stuff on the .NET framework to being open source, like ASP.NET, SignalR. Even the Roslyn compilers are, since the build conference, now being open source. So people can leverage that technology and do great stuff with that. So one of the things they announced at Build somewhere in April this year is that they now started the .NET Foundation, meaning that a lot of the stuff that they do is now being published to the open source community. And also you see that a lot of other companies and open source initiatives signed up for this .NET Foundation, and they're contributing through that. So you see the Xamarin stuff in here. You see some of the stuff from Laurent Billon from Identity Mine, which is more in the WPF space, like the MVVM stuff he has. So there's a lot of stuff being published there, even Couchbase and all that cool stuff. So you see there's a lot of stuff going on in this open source environment. And we really need to have a look at, okay, what are the best practices then for your enterprise, you might ask. Well, funny enough, Microsoft is just getting started in this space. So how can it be that we already have best practices in this area? And the simple thing about best practices is that you should also look on the other side of the fence sometimes to learn what others already achieved in the past years. And what you see is that if you look at, for example, the Java ecosystem, the guys that do Java and do Linux development, they've been using open source for years. And they know already a lot of stuff on how to cope with this in the enterprise. So what I will do this afternoon is show you some of the stuff that I came along and learned myself regarding using open source in the enterprise, because I've done a lot of engagements with large banks, insurance companies that have like heterogeneous application lifecycle management environments doing Java, common off the shelf products, and also .NET development. So not only that, I also want to put in my personal experiences as being a CTO and have been a technology manager for quite a while, and what are my concerns if it comes to open source, and what is it that we really need to cope with? So the challenges for the enterprise are twofold here. So on the one hand, you would like to provide as much freedom as possible for all your developers. You want to provide the freedom so they can be as productive as possible. It's not for nothing that we're all starting to do agile and we want to be more productive. We want to create more value as soon as possible. But what you see is that the tools that we then start using and we want to leverage are all pulling in these open source packages. And what you see is that tools that we have like Visual Studio highly encourage this. If we work not only in Visual Studio, but if you, for example, look at ASP.NET VNext, you see that also there in that space, there are many packet managers that you can use out there that pull in these packages like Node Package Manager, the Bower Package Manager if you're doing more on the JavaScript client side, Maven, of course, not only being an environment for your builds, but also pulling in from central repositories the packages that are needed to do the build, to do these builds. NuGet, of course, something that we all know and love for quite some years now. And you see that the pickup on NuGet is pretty steep and pretty rapidly growing. So from that perspective, I want to provide as much flexibility and freedom for my developers in my ecosystem so that they can be as productive as possible. But on the other hand, I also need to be aware of the risks that might be in place when it comes to using open source. And I will dive into that a little bit later and when we talk about the different types of licenses, for example, in the software that we're going to pull in. Okay? So how can I make my .NET developers, my developers happy and still be flexible within my enterprise and being risk aware? So what is it that I'm exposing my company to when I'm pulling in all this open source stuff? Now, if you look at the open source implications for the enterprise, then there are a couple of things that we need to go through this afternoon. So first I will start off with, what is open source anyway? I mean, does it mean that if I publish some code on my blog, it's all of a sudden open source, or is it more involved on becoming or making something open source out there? Then we have to look at stuff like, okay, now imagine that I have some cool stuff here and I find an interesting business model. What are the normal steps that you do when you start contributing to open source or even publishing open source? And from that, I take in the other approach and say, okay, well, let's not assume that you have that as a first step, but just start with consuming this stuff. What are the things that we need to look at? For example, licensing and known vulnerabilities, and how can we track this stuff within our enterprise? So if we come to the first question, what is open source anyway? Then we need to start out with one fundamental thing that is globally something that people are affected with, is that's the fact that the moment you start writing code, that code is being copyrighted right away. And you, as the person behind the keyboard, are the copyright holder of that particular software. Meaning that me dumping out that code just on the internet and not saying anything about it, it does not get rid of that copyright that you have at that point in time. That's something to think of. So if we really look at open source, then open source is source code that needs to be made available under a license. And when you make it available under a license, that's the moment that we say, okay, and these are the boundaries within you can use my software. And this is what you can do in terms of distributing that software and using that software. And based on that, we can make some conscious decisions on what we really can do with it in terms of our enterprise environment. So according to the open source definition, these licenses must not discriminate against any persons or groups. So you cannot say, I'm going to publish this software, but everybody that has red hair cannot use it. Okay, it would be an interesting thing to do, by the way, but that's not allowed. Okay, you cannot discriminate. You need to be specific to a particular product that you're doing, and the restriction on other software is something that you need to be very careful about as well. If you want to read more about that, you can go to opensource.org, OSD. There's a whole bunch of documentation on where licenses should comply to in terms of being an open source license. Now, if you look at licensing, then that's, I think, the most convoluted story out there if you look at open source. What you see is that the licensing licenses involved when you're using open source can fall in different buckets. Okay, so if you look at the different ways to look at the licensing spectrum, you can see that, well, on the one hand, we have like the restrictive licenses. And on the other hand, we have the very permissive licenses. You can do more or less anything with it. And if you look at the red box over here, that's the stuff that everybody is talking about, and that's what everybody is scared about, and that's what enterprises face as something, we don't go there. Because what this means is that we have this notion of copyleft. Now, I just started with the fact that once you write code, this code is automatically copyrighted, copyright. So the idea here is that copyleft is more like a joke, right? So instead of copyright, we're now doing copyleft. So what does that mean? Is it now all of a sudden free and I'm just throwing away all my rights? Well, the whole idea behind the copyleft is that you very specifically restrict what can be done with the source that you publish. And with the GPL licenses, the LGPL and the AGPL licenses, you're more or less saying that once you use this software and you're making changes to the software, and then you start distributing that software, all of a sudden you need to distribute your own IP as well. It needs to be part of that. You can't. You need to have your software that you built with that open source stuff under the same license as the stuff that you've been using. So that's the reason that these copyleft licenses, as they are called in the more general way, in the general bucket, are called the viral licenses. And that's what everybody is scared of. So all of a sudden, I'm writing this code. I have my intellectual property of doing some cool stuff. And all of a sudden, I find out that I've been using a GPL license. And now all of a sudden, everything is out in the open. And that's what scares a lot of enterprises, because it might not be apparent straight away, because just somebody pulled in some sources, you're doing your stuff, and then somebody comes by and says, well, I inspected your stuff there, and you have my code in there. And all of a sudden, you're obligated to publish that to the outer world, and not even to mention the lawsuits that you can get into and the money that you need to pay for the infringement on the copyleft license in that particular case. So that's the very restrictive version of these licenses. Then we have this notion of downstream licenses, the Eclipse public license, for example, the Microsoft licenses out there. And those licenses are less restrictive. What they more or less say is that the code that you've been incorporated must be passed along with the same rights that you've been pulling it. So you cannot more or less publish that under another license. But it does not always imply that you need to publish your own sources as well. Okay, so there's more like a gray area there. And then we have the attribution licenses, which is more in the spectrum. Well, if you just say that you've been using this stuff and just attributing the fact that they just contributed to your sources, then you're fine. It's just the statement, I've been using this and this and this stuff, and your release notes would be fine. Okay, and you can then just use this stuff. So you see the right, very restrictive. You see the left, very liberal, you might say. So from this perspective, you can say, okay, I can still work based on all this open source stuff, but I need to be very specific about which sources can I use or should I be very careful about. By the way, I'm not saying that the red stuff is not usable at all, because if you're just building stuff for your enterprise and you're not building a product that you're going to ship to somebody else, so you're not distributing your sources, you're just using your sources, GPL is fine. I mean, the people that just raise their hands and running a Linux environment do not all of a sudden need to publish everything they have on their servers or anything they've done with that. And even if they modify the Linux copy, they can do whatever they want with that and just run it. The moment you distribute your software, you're triggering the license obligations. And that's a very important thing to think about. So looking at copyleft, the distribution gets triggered. The license obligations get triggered by the fact that you're distributing the software. Okay? meaning that you build something based on the open source stuff, and then the moment you publish that to someone else, you need to publish your own stuff as well. So what are the obligations there? Well, the thing that you need to do is you need to disclose the source code of your product. So anything that you've been writing and using the GPL licenses needs to be published. You need to make that code available under the copyleft license. You cannot restrict it in any other way. And the thing is that if you have any patents in that, you're licensing that with it as well. So you're more or less throwing your patents out in the open as well. So once your product is available under a copyleft license, then anyone who receives that code can just distribute it without any charge. And this is where the stuff that scares people most. Okay? Now then you might ask yourself, okay, interestingly enough, these days we're not really distributing our software anymore. We are more in the cloud space. Okay? So who of you are using cloud? Only a couple. Yeah, we're in Europe, right? We're not in America, so we're more restrictive in terms of using the cloud. But nevertheless, you see a lot of new... With the cloud, I, by the way, do not mean only the public cloud, right? You might have your own cloud infrastructure where you run stuff, but okay. So one of the things that you need to be aware of is the fact that I'm building software based on open source, and all of a sudden I'm saying I'm going to provide my software services as software as a service, a SaaS solution to the outside world. Now the question is, do I now at this moment distribute my source, or am I just providing a service? And this is where the licensing can be very tricky, and you need to be very aware of the fact that you have copyleft licenses, and in that particular case, like normal GPL licenses, using that in a cloud scenario, so you, building your software and then producing new software based on that and then using that as a SaaS service or a cloud service, does not trigger the license obligations. Only when you're using specific licenses like a GPL European Union license and a common public license, then using that in a cloud service also triggers the obligation. You need to then publish that stuff. Okay, so that's very important to know as well. So most of the time you're good here, but be aware of these other licenses that have this specific note about using the software in a cloud scenario, or like they more or less say, well, providing this service in a cloud scenario all of a sudden triggers the obligations as well. You need to be aware of that. So I think enough said on the licensing part. I was thinking of doing a demo here in terms of, okay, I'm a tech head and they always ask me, you need to do a lot of demos. And I thought, well, why not read through such a license with it all, right? That would be fun or not? Okay. So contributing to open source. I think that, so we have two ways of looking at open source. One is contributing, and it's more or less the simplest part, I would say. And then we have like the using part, and that I will cover later. So contributing to open source, you might think of that in like a certain set of steps. What you see most at the time is that people start just using the software, which I will dive into deeper later, where you just download the stuff, look at it, make a fork of it, do some fiddling around with it, but not really seriously doing anything else with it. Then from that point on, you might say, well, interestingly enough, I would like to contribute some time when I'm using this open source stuff. Now, contributing time is a very important part of using open source as well. I will cover that later as well, because when I'm using open source and people are contributing to that and it's all going a specific direction, I might want to be part of that specific direction so I'm not breaking compatibility with my sources and all that kind of stuff. Okay, so you might do logging of bugs, you might answer questions, fix some documentation. That's the way you most of the time can get started in these communities on contributing to open source. Now, if you go one step further, then you need to be involved in the community, and then all of a sudden you are the one that's really fixing bugs, maintaining stuff, translating code, whatever, and contributing that to the source lines. And finally, you might even own a certain part or a certain specific open source product, and then you become a committer. You get write access. You get write access to, for example, or you would be one of the guys that is pulling in those pull requests and then evaluating if that stuff really makes sense for your particular piece of software that you're putting out in the open. So if you look at publishing open source, then there are some things that you need to know about what you need to get in place before you can do this. Because it's very interesting to say, well, I've just these three guys out here, we just meet up every Wednesday night and we're just starting coding away and we think it's nice to just publish that as open source. Well, the question is, what is it that I need to get in place before it can be open source? Because we just learned that just putting it out on my blog will not help because it's still copyrighted stuff at that moment. So we need to figure out a way to license that under an open source license. But before we can do so, we need to exactly know who worked on the code. And once we know who worked on the code, then we can ask those people to buy into the new license and more or less waive their copyright rights and move that to the open source license rights that you then put out in the open. Okay? So publishing software on your blog and not saying anything about licensing there makes your software more or less unusable for companies out in the open. And the reason is because it's always copyrighted. And you need to add a license to it before it can be used. Otherwise, they will be in a sketchy situation when they're using your stuff and all of a sudden 3 months later you think, wow, this thing gone viral, let's ask some money for that stuff. Okay. So you really need to make sure that you put a license on the software that you put out in the open before people can actually use it. And this is one of the things that most people do not know. But this is also a reason that a lot of stuff cannot just be open sourced. Many people just ask, for example, why did Microsoft not, for example, publish VB as open source? Because there's still VB out there and we could support it as community. Okay, so look at a source base of Visual Basic 6. Who contributed to that code? Do you think Microsoft still knows who all contributed to that code base? Well, I think it's a hell of a job to at least know who did it and then waive their rights and then put it out in the open. And perhaps they might want to scrub some stuff as well. But that said behind, it's still something that you need to be aware of. It's not just throwing stuff over the fence and now it's being open source. It's very something you need to be aware of. Now, when you start an open source community or you start an open source project, you need to be aware of the fact that you need to more or less sign people up with what we call a contributor license agreement. And this contributor license agreement ensures that the people who contribute to your project are then saying, well, I comply with the open source license that we publish this stuff with, and I more or less waive my copyright rights. Okay, so be sure that when you start this stuff, you sign these contributor license agreements. And by the way, you see a lot of stuff on GitHub these days. People did not sign these agreements yet. And GitHub is now reaching out to a lot of the communities and say, you need to get these licenses in place because otherwise you still might be in trouble. But then you might question yourself, but why the heck would I contribute to open source? Or why would I start open source anyway? And you see that these days that open source has become a very viable business model. You see that a lot of companies all of a sudden think, well, we had this private build and we have this public stuff and we do a partially open source and we have some closed source stuff to add to that. Yesterday I talked to the people from Chef and they were telling me that they are now starting to move away from the private stuff and just pushing everything to open source. And the reason for that is because there's a very viable business model behind that. And the viable business model is more or less, if you are the main contributor of that repository, if you are the one that publishes that stuff, then you are probably the authority in that space. And people are very willing to pay you money for consulting services, additional premium services to fix stuff for them, or just have like support on the software that they put in their production environments. So there's a lot of stuff you can do around these open source initiatives, and there's a very viable business model that you can think of. And one of the things that I said, I just started this new company, and one of the things we are thinking of is, okay, what kind of open source stuff might we be going to do in the next few years? Because it's very interesting to see that we, as a company, then can be an authority in that particular space and provide consulting services in that space as well. So enough said about consuming open source, because I think that most of you, so who of you are today contributing to open source? Only a couple. Okay. About five or six people in the room. Okay. So who of you are consuming open source today? Right. And that's the reason I thought I would spend most of the time on actually consuming open source and the things that we need to think of if we are working in an enterprise. So if we're consuming open source from the web, being pictured here as the big cloud, we're trickling in these packages, these components, and we then put them into our development cycle, and then based on that, we build our own products and we deploy our products, and then we put that into production. You can think of this as being a supply chain for building your software, and the supply chain starts with the suppliers of the open source stuff that you want to pull in. Now, if you look at this, then there are some things that you need to be aware of besides the licensing, and that's the fact that a lot of these components might not be secure or safe. There are a lot of open source initiatives out there that still have a lot of vulnerabilities in their software that you need to be aware of. And if you're pulling in these components from the outer web, and you're pushing that into your code base, all of a sudden you might have exploits in your software, and you need to be aware of that. We all probably remember the Heartbleed incident that we had, where all these HTTPS stacks all of a sudden got quite a leak in terms of getting secure information out of the stack. So if you look at that, then we need to find a way to at least know what software is it that we are pulling in to our software production process that we have ourselves. So the question is then, okay, so we're pulling in these components. How can I empower my developers but still have this flexibility to be out in the open and just pulling in these sources? And for that, we just need to know what's in use in our enterprise. And that's more or less the important question that we need to answer. Now, if we look at that, what can we then learn from the Java community and the Java space that we had out there? Well, in the Java community, it's very common to use things that they call artifact repositories. Okay. And these artifact repositories are then used as a means to pull the packages and provide more or less like a proxy layer, and then even push their sources to that repository as well later on when they are building that software. Okay. Now, using such an artifact repository all of a sudden provides us with a single point that we can then look at and see what's in use in our environment. Now, what's in use in the Microsoft space is some complete different notion. We're pulling the packages from the web, just using a NuGet feed, or if you're doing a little bit more on NuGet, you might have your private feed being a web server, being just a folder on your network, but still you're pulling those packages. Based on the private repositories, you at least know what they're pulling, but okay, nevertheless, NuGet might not be the only way to get those sources in there. But then what we have is we have like our software in our version control repository, and what we do is we build our products, and then what we do is we just dump it on a network share. That's what we call our drop location. Okay. So in the Microsoft world, we can learn a lot of the using, for example, these artifact repositories, and that's what I will dive into a little bit deeper and show you what can be done with this stuff. So if you look at this picture over here, you still see that I'm pulling the software over there, but what I'm doing is I'm putting an artifact repository in the middle, and that's there to be used as a cache mechanism, but also being a place where I can then look up what's in use when we're looking at the software that we pulled in from the outside. Okay, so once we have such an artifact repository in place, we all of a sudden then can say, oh, I might be able to scan for licenses because I know what software is in there. I might be able to look for known vulnerabilities. And I can also, and that's one other important thing with open source, how popular is the stuff that we're pulling in? I mean, who of you have been using Knockout for the past few years? Who's using Angular? More of you are. Okay, so what you saw all of a sudden is that, especially in the Microsoft ecosystem, Knockout was a very popular data binding library in the JavaScript space. And all of a sudden, we saw that everybody is then moving over to the Angular world, and that's being more predominantly used. So one of the things that, personally, I, as the CTO of our company, I am very interested in the fact, okay, so what's the software that we're pulling from the interweb? And based on that, how popular is this stuff? Or do we see people fleeting to just different technologies, and all of a sudden, I'm the sole one using that repository, and all of a sudden, I need to maintain that stuff, okay? So that's something that you need to be aware of as well. So if you look at artifact repositories, there are a couple of them out there. A couple of vendors out there, Archiva, Artifactory, and Nexus are the repositories being used most. I put up a link here that you can look at the comparison between those artifact repositories. But what I will be doing is I will be showing the Nexus repository for you to show what can be done with all this stuff and how we can use that. Because one of the things that the guys from Sonatype did is they added support in their open source version of Nexus for NuGet. So instead of only being a Maven repository, we can now also use it as a NuGet repository centrally in our, managed in our environment, which is pretty neat, I would say. Okay. So let's have a short look at the Nexus repository. And what I will show you, great. What I will show you is, I just started this web application, right? And I think that nobody really noticed the fact that I am not using a straight NuGet feed here. If I go here to my Packages Explorer, Manage Packages, you see here that these are all my components. But when I look, for example, to the updates that I might have here, you see that I have this feed here called NuGet. Well, it's now looking through the proxy if there's any NuGet stuff out there. So what I have here is I have a connection open to a virtual machine in the cloud. So I've created like a virtual private network, and I have Team Foundation Server in there and all that other good stuff that you want to do for application lifecycle management. And I also placed there a Nexus repository. Now what you see here is that in this Nexus environment, I can now say, okay, let me see what repositories are in there. And what you can do is you can then have a look at, for example, my NuGet org proxy. And what I've done here, and when I browse this over here, you can see that this is all the components that I just pulled in using a simple ASP.NET web application. So it's just gone out to the web, and then it proxied all that stuff in there. And now I can have a look at what's in use based on people going to that feed that I have published internally in my my enterprise. Okay, so you can see here that I'm using, for example, some of the JSON stuff, and you can see that it now pulled in all the packages that might be used in that particular area. Okay, and based on this, I can then look further and see, okay, what's in these packages, because, well, there are nothing more than NuGet packages, so you can see what stuff is in there, like Newton stuff, and then you can see where the stuff came from, how big it is, etc. So this is an interesting part of providing the flexibility for your enterprise developers while still being more or less in control of what the stuff is that they're using in terms of, at least I know what they're using. So that's the first starting point that we need to get in place. Okay. Now, for such a repository to be created, I will log in for a moment. And when I log in, I get some additional information on the NuGet proxy. And what you can see here is in the configuration, the only thing I needed to do is I needed to set up where it's actually going to. Okay, so you see here, this is just a normal original feed of NuGet, and now we have this intermediary just proxying that stuff through there. Okay. Now if we look at Visual Studio over here, you see that this is just a normal regular feed, and I can just do an update all here, and I just get all the updated sources, and then they are being pulled from my artifact repo being Nexus. Okay, I'm going to accept that. It's going to pull all this stuff in there. I'm just updating this stuff. And you see that this is convenient in two ways, because in the enterprise I encountered many times that people are not allowed to use the internet directly. So you can still provide a NuGet feed into this repository, and that this repository might go out to the web. Or you might say, well, I'm just using that as like a central point, and I'm going to put in stuff that is more or less, let's say, vouch for that's allowed in our enterprise. I'm more in the camp that leave people use what they want to use, and then audit that from that point on, and see that we have the conversation if we're pulling in stuff that might be tricky for our organization. Now, if I go to settings here, the only thing I've done is I've set up a NuGet source, and you see that I'm going to my own cloud environment. So this is my Fluent Bytes at my cloudapp.net, which is nothing more than an Azure virtual machine, running my Team Foundation server and running this Nexus server. Okay, so you see that it's more or less friction-free, and the only thing that we needed to do is we needed to set up this feed to that proxy and then get rid of more or less the default proxy that you have for NuGet. Okay, so a very easy step to do, and all of a sudden I can at least see what's in use in my environment. So great. We now have a way to proxy all the stuff that comes from NuGet, but then you might ask yourself, yeah, Marcel, it's a great story, but not all open source just comes through NuGet. And you're completely right. I just said we have like Node, NPM, we have Bower, we have all kinds of other package managers, and we have something like a browser where we can download anything with what we want. So what we need to do is, in order to have more understanding on what's actually being used in our enterprise, is we need to not only have a proxy, but we also need to have a way to publish what we've built back to that same repository. So then we create this central point where all our code is being maintained and kept. And that's where artifact repositories are for. You have your source code repository for your sources, and you have your artifact repository for all your binaries that you produce. And by the way, for the people that start using Git, for example, you might see this as a great opportunity as well, because we all know that Git is not the most brilliant environment to put in binaries, which you might have been doing with Team Foundation version control, for example. Okay, so using that artifact repository not only offloads your Git repository, it also provides you the central location where you now can keep those sources and keep them safe and at least know what's in there. So this was a picture that we just saw. So I had the artifact repository more or less only as a proxy in there. But what we need to do is we need to take it one step further. So what we're going to do is we are going to say, okay, I'm spreading out this artifact repository. What I'm going to do is, when I'm doing my builds, I'm going to push them up to my artifact repository as well. Okay? Now, from that point on, like I said, I do a lot of work also in the continuous delivery spectrum. And what you see is that different approaches are there, that people are just pushing builds into production just using their team build or using Jenkins or whatever. But you might think of, okay, now I'm just handing it off to this artifact repository, and this artifact repository now becomes this central point that can be a handoff point to anywhere in my environment. The great thing about the artifact repository is that it also can then function as the bridge between different networks, for example, when you want to push to different environments. Okay? So artifact repositories can be placed there in the middle, and we're doing then our builds, and our builds are going to be published to the artifact repository. So for that to happen, what is it that we need to do? And I will show you very briefly how you can do this in a very convenient manner. So what I have for this is I created this very fancy application. This application is called Console Application 1. And this Console Application 1 is doing what everybody is always programming at their first day of programming. It's the Hello World application. And why did I not spend a lot of time here? Because this is not the point. It's not the point what I'm building. It's more where I'm handing over my stuff and how do I cope with that. And what I've done is the following. Like I said, I use Team Foundation Server here. And what I've done is I put this stuff into my source control repository. So you can see over here that I have my sources, and within MVC demo, I have this console application over here. So here are my sources. And then the question is, where are my binaries? Well, my binaries are binaries that I build each and every day. So when I go to my build definition, what I've done is I've now used a different build template. So what you can do is you can go out to Coplex, and at Coplex there is this NuGetter. And NuGetter is a way of integrating NuGet into your builds. What you see these days is that Microsoft is already working its way along to just after you build your stuff, you get a NuGet package out of that. Well, we see that becoming more and more the case. But you can do it already today by using the NuGetter open source package. Use that template. And in this template, what we need to do is we need to only specify a couple of things. So just going back to my repository over here, what you see when I go to NuGet over here, you see that this is the endpoint of my NuGet repository. So this is what I configured to be the proxy point for Visual Studio. Now you see the other thing there, that's the personal API key. Now this personal API key is a key that I can use to also publish to this repository. Okay? So what I've done in my template over here is I set up this build, a very simple build. I just said, well, I would like you to build my solution, which is nothing more than a console application. And what I'm doing is I'm setting up the NuGetter activities to use NuGet, which is part of my repository. So NuGet.exe is part of my Visual Studio repository. I just put it in there in Team Foundation Server. And I am specifying what is the specification of this package. And I will look at that in a few seconds. And then after I have this new spec, what I'm doing is I'm providing the key over here to publish to my artifact repository. And I'm providing here the endpoint where I can publish to. Now, by the way, if you're doing that out in the open and you have something that's significant, use HTTPS, of course. I just used HTTP because I didn't want to set up all the certificate stuff. But I think you get the point there. And then you put here invoke push switch to true, and then all of a sudden you can push to the artifact repository. Now, if you look at the NuGet spec, the only thing I've done is I've created a very simple specification here, and I'm going to publish the 1.0.2 version, and I just incorporate there the executable, the config file, and the PDB that comes out of my build. Okay. Now, again, this is a very simple example. It's just driving the point that you can publish to your NuGet repositories in a very easy and convenient way. So the only thing that I need to do is I already, let me check. Did I check in the new spec? Yeah, it's checked in. So the only thing I need to do is here click on queue a new build. And before I do so, I will have a look here. I have this endpoint over here, local packages. So I created the second repository just for the local packages. And what you can do is then create what we call a NuGet group that then gets the feed from both sides. So gets the Microsoft feed and your own feed as one. Okay. So in this particular case, I set up a local NuGet repository. And in this local repository, if I browse the storage, you can see that I have the console application 1.1, and I'm going to publish a new one, 1.02. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to queue up this build, and we can then wait for a couple of seconds, and I will come back to this once it's finished. I will show you in the next couple of minutes that this just published to our NuGet repository. Okay, so that's the way you set this up. Pretty easy to do, and in the future it becomes more and more easy to do because Microsoft is already providing you with all the stuff to get your NuGet packages set up, and you can just very easily package up your console application, your WPF application, or your web application, and then use the artifact repository as the handoff point for your continuous delivery pipeline. So great, now I have an artifact repository, but how the heck does that solve my needs? Because I've been telling you stuff about licensing, and I've been telling you stuff about vulnerabilities. But I haven't shown you anything about licensing and vulnerabilities, only that I can pull stuff from the interweb and cache it and push it into a NuGet repository. So thanks, Marcel, you didn't really solve my problem here, right? So the thing is that once we have this stuff in our repository, we can do all kinds of cool stuff with it. And what I found is that the guys from Nexus guys from Sonatype did a great job here, because they provide all of a sudden some means and some tools to do artifact scans. And those scans can then all of a sudden deliver me information on what were the licenses that I was using when I pulled in these sources. What are the known vulnerabilities on the components that I all of a sudden depend on? And one of the other things is, how popular are these components that I'm using? And they're pulling in that data from their data warehouses and provide me with all these insights just based on the fact that I have this stuff in my NuGet repository. So what I just want to show you is, after, of course, I will show you that my stuff just got published to my artifact repository, I will also show you that we can do these health scans. So if you look here, you see that my build just succeeded. And if I go and look at my NuGet repository and I refresh this thing over here, you can now see that I have the 102, and it's very nicely being pushed to this repository. Okay? So that was like for my previous demo, getting the stuff into my repository. Now, some of you might already have noticed that I have in this repository two specific things over here. You see like the shield and the badge over here at my NuGet repository, and you see the same at Central. Now, Central is just a Maven repository, and I've been doing some builds with Maven where I just built some stuff. I built rebuilt Eclipse, WebGoat, some other stuff, just to pull in enough stuff to do such an artifact scan, so you can see how that looks on the Java side. And since the guys from Sonatype now also support partially already this feature on NuGet feeds, because NuGet feeds are just barely in there at the moment, you can already see that I have 102 at least notions of license scans that they have done. So the vulnerabilities, they are coming very soon. They told me the next quarter the vulnerability scan will be in there as well. But first, let's have a look what we can look at here. So when I hover over this thing, you can now all of a sudden see that it did a scan. You can also see that the internet just, the connection just died on me. Thank you very much. Ah, we're back again. Cool. So what you see here is that I have this scan that runs once a day, and it looks at all the artifacts in my NuGet repository, and it did a scan, and it found that I've used 93 licenses which it cannot define. So there are just special licenses or licenses that have been tweaked for their specific needs. And we have 9 pieces of components that do not even provide any license information. Now, if there's no license at all, that means that the copyright laws just apply to that stuff. And we really need to have a chat with these guys and make sure that they either will publish this stuff, or we need to get rid of it, because otherwise we might get sued for infringements later on. And you see here that there are no vulnerabilities in there yet. Well, that has to do with the fact that there's no vulnerability scan in there yet. But like I said, that will be in one of the next releases of this piece of software. Now, if I have a look at here at the scans that have been done on my Maven repository, you can see that I even have 4 criticals in terms of vulnerabilities. So what I will do is I will just fire up a second piece of software that I can use to dive even deeper in this software and look what is actually going on here. You see that I don't have copyleft licenses. I got a couple of non-standard. I got a weak copyleft, so the middle bucket that I was talking about, and the liberal licenses on the right-hand side. By the way, I did not cover on the weak copyleft and the GPL licenses the fact that the way you bind to that software defines also if you're needing to adhere to the copyleft obligations. So if you do dynamic linking, most of the time that is being... Well, it's more or less the common understanding that if you do dynamic linking, you do not have to publish your sources as being the GPL sources as well. But if you do static linking, you do. Okay. And one of the things that might be interesting for you to know is that Microsoft, within Visual Studio these days, ships stuff that is GPL licensed. And that has to do with their Git integration. They just took a dependency on libgit2. And libgit2 is just such a thing that they found a way to link to it in a correct way, so they don't have to provide the whole Visual Studio environment as open source all of a sudden. Okay, so it's doable in the enterprise to work with these licenses. So What I have is a second product that Sonatype provides, and that's what they call their CLM environment. I will dive into that later, what it actually means. But in their CLM environment, I can have this dashboard where I can see all this open source stuff that's being used and the scans that I've done over that. And I can set certain policies and rules for my environment. Because the thing is that if I need to go to this architect each and every time when I want to use a piece of open source, then perhaps he might not have his day and say no, and next week he might say yeah. So what are the real rules based on which we decide what is good and what is bad for our enterprise? So what you can do within the CLM product is you can then set up policies where you say, well, I do not allow any software in there with these specific licenses, or I do not allow, for example, software to be incorporated when we have like prior threat level number 8 or 9 in the known vulnerabilities database, like the OWASP top 10 and that kind of stuff. So what I will do is I will just have a look at reporting here. And what I've done is WebGoat is this package that you can download, which shows a lot of vulnerabilities in some of the Java software. And you see the scan here that's been done. And what I can do is I can have a look here, and I can, for example, look at the license analysis. And you see that, for example, they're using log4j, and log4j is not really declared. They think it's Apache, but something that you need to check at least what's the case at that point in time. You can also see with the little glyph there, what is the version that we are using, and what's the version that's out there in the open. Okay, so you see that I'm lagging behind a lot of versions, so this might be a good moment to upgrade my stuff as well. Okay. Now, that's very nice, of course, but what's also interesting is the security issues that I might have. And you see that I even have a threat level number 9 in here, and when we go and look at what that stuff is, we can have a look here, and we can see what is the component that we're using, and since when was that security vulnerability being introduced, so in which version? And in which version is that security vulnerability being fixed? So now I can see that I'm currently using this version 1.807. And that is, by the way, an 8-year-old bug in there that's still being used in my software at this point in time. But I can say, well, what about this version? And you can see, well, this has been published 5 years ago, but it does not have the known vulnerability anymore. And when I want to know what vulnerability this is, I can just have a look at that as well. I can just click this link. And it will go to the database and show me which vulnerability am I exposed to. So imagine that you pulled in these sources for HTTPS, and you have this Heartbleed thing going on. All of a sudden, this scan can then show you in this detailed report what is being hit with this vulnerability and where you need to take countermeasures in your environment to fix that problem. So you see that there's a lot more involved in using open source than just knowing the licenses, because you need to, all of a sudden, need to know what kind of stuff am I pulling in, which is already being known as a known vulnerability, and I'm just incorporating that. And well, if we have an attribution license, I'm doing a release note showing that I'm using this stuff. That's great for hackers, right? They know exactly what stuff there's in there, and they exactly know what to exploit. So be careful about that and make sure that you do these kinds of scans and ensure that you don't bring your enterprise into any risk situations with the use of your open source stuff. Now, by the way, I didn't go into very much detail because I'm not selling this CLM product, right? I'm just using the stuff that I see being used out in the open. And I work with the guys from Sonatype to show me some of this stuff that they've been working on and showing me where this is heading to in the future. And like I said, I try to learn here from my experiences out in the open, and I'm also learning from what's been done in the Java communities so that we can incorporate that as practices for ourselves in our enterprise. So what I showed you today is only parts of the puzzle, right? I mean, we now know stuff about licensing. We know that our artifact repository can help us empower our developers in the way they use the software out in the open and just can pull in stuff from NuGet feeds and pull in stuff from Maven or whatever. But it can analyze stuff, but there is still stuff that you need to think of yourself. And one of the things that you still need to think of yourself is, for example, what is the open source that we're going to select and pick? Like I said, we have something like Knockout in the past, and all of a sudden now Angular is more popular and we're using that. So how are we coping with that? Especially in the web space, you see that we are moving in a pretty rapid pace to different software stacks that we might want to use. So that's something that you need to be aware of as well. Then there's other stuff that you need to be aware of, and that's how do you select this right component in the abundance of choice, we call it, and how do I engage with communities? Because when I engage with like component factories within my enterprise, most of the time we see these organizational units that build components for the enterprise, I'm now pulling in stuff from the web. So now we need to have this conversation at our CXO level and say, yeah, dude, I'm using now this open source software. I need to have time to contribute to that as well. And that's always an interesting conversation with management when you say, well, thank you, but these 2 days I'm going to contribute to open source. And all of a sudden they go, wait a minute, open source, is that something that we give away for free? That does not resonate with my spreadsheet and the way we do business here. And that's something that you need to figure out and work with your superiors to get that stuff going. Because if you do not engage with communities, you cannot say anything about what they're doing. You cannot say that they should have fixed something that you're waiting for, because you need to contribute, because that's the way the open source ecosystem works. And you need to figure out a way how you're going to manage that and how you're going to manage these contributions to open source communities as well. So one of the things I did not cover today, because I think being at the last session of the day, I wouldn't stretch it like 50 minutes over time and give you guys some more time to come up with questions, for example. So what I did not cover is stuff like, okay, so these vulnerability scans, these license scans, how do I incorporate those into my continuous delivery pipeline? Because now I have this stuff in my repository. What am I going to do? Am I going to look into that every day? Am I going to stop the builds from that? But the thing is, if you look at, for example, the CLM product that Sonatype has, you can even incorporate that into your build pipelines. You can say, I would like to do these scans, and based on the results of that scan, I can flag this build as being failed, because all of a sudden somebody pulled in a package that has the AGPL license, for example, and that makes me publish everything because I'm doing like a SaaS solution. It's something that you really need to be aware of, and then you say, whoa, I'm not going to accept that commit into my repository, because all of a sudden I'm now publishing my sources as open source while I'm trying to run a business here. Okay? So those are the things that you can do. You need to now plug it into your build and delivery pipelines. And you can use any software you're used to, like Microsoft Release Manager, other tools that you're used to do the continuous delivery to test and production environments. The other thing that you need to do is you need to set up those policies within your enterprise. You need to set up these policies. What kind of licenses do we agree are viable for our enterprise by default? And what is the stuff that we need to have a chat about and might need to involve legal so we ensure that we're not exposing ourselves to any of the copyleft obligations that all of a sudden might render us out of business? Now, the other thing that you need to fight within your organization, and I try to help organizations with that as well, is that there's a lot of developer bias. What you see is that Java developers do not talk to the .NET developers, and .NET developers do not talk with the Java community. That's my general feeling when I go in these enterprises. You see that most of the time they're in different locations even, okay? So let alone that they will ever talk to each other. But we can learn so much from each other. And one of the other things is that a lot of people just still want to build it themselves. People just still have this not invented here syndrome, and they still want to build their own FTP libraries to do FTP while there's so much stuff out there. So please, 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 please do not build all the stuff yourself, because it's just so cool and I can wear this t-shirt that I'm a hacker. I mean, you can better be safe sitting out with a beer and enjoy time with your wife and just pulling in some of these packages, as long as they adhere to the policies that you set within your enterprise. So be aware of that. And please look at the other side of the fence. There's so much we can learn from each other, and learning from each other makes us all grow. If we grow, they grow, everybody grows. And that's the way we build greater software day in day, day after day. So to summarize, I hope that I've shown you today that there is more to open source than just source code. There are stuff that we need to know about licensing. You don't need to know the nitty-gritty details. That's why I did not read with each other like the license agreements. If you know in which bucket it falls, you know for sure that's safe stuff, that's stuff that I need to be aware of, that stuff, viral, might be tricky. At least need to have a lawyer in there that understands open source and understands what I'm doing as a business, and based on that, make conscious decisions. You need to understand the open source ecosystem and how you need to contribute, and how you need contributions to make these communities be viable and live for a longer period of time, because you're taking dependencies on that software, so you need to nurture those communities as well. Go to their meetups, join them, help them out, do translations at first, and then finally even do bug fixes and pull requests. Set up a strategy in your company to do something like I showed you today with artifact repositories, for example, to function as a proxy, push it up to that certain central location, and based on that, be able to do artifact scans, know what your vulnerabilities are, know where you can find the fixes for those vulnerabilities, and how you can fix that in your software. The great thing with working with the Sonatype guys is that I learned that they completely committed to the open source in the .NET communities these days, so not only focusing on Java anymore. And with that, we all of a sudden get all these cool capabilities now for our .NET code as well, which makes it, for me at least, a very viable choice for our environments to use, ensure that we are not pulling in stuff that might render us obsolete after a couple of years. So the artifact repositories are not the answer to the puzzle. They can help you as being a part of the puzzle of getting open source in your enterprise and getting that set up correctly. With that, I would like to ask you, please submit your evals. I really read those evals. They are very valuable for me, so I can improve these talks and make sure that I deliver the right value for you. I also do iterative development of these presentations, so I provide more value each and every time. So please be so kind to fill out these eval forms. And if you want to have a Pluralsight subscription for a month for free, you can come up to me. I will first look at your evaluation scores, of course. No, I'm just kidding. And with that, I would like to thank you all for coming, and have a safe trip home, and I hope you guys all enjoy TechEd this year. Thank you. There might be people that have questions. If you can shout them out, I can then repeat them so they are also recorded. So any questions left? Okay, no questions. You can always reach me on Twitter, @MarcelV, and see you next time.